call this meeting to order, and good morning, everyone.
On a chilly February morning, we've been spoiled all winter, and now we are getting a little bit of our real winter, so welcome. Before we start today, I would like to talk a little bit about the Minnesota property tax comment line. That was launched on Monday, and the intent of that is to give residents a direct input into how property taxes are impacting them, and also to offer any ideas or suggestions on how we might lower property taxes. And I think the strength and success of this division is going to depend on input from the public. So the public is encouraged to provide that input. There are phone numbers, there's an email address, and members, we will be keeping all of the input in this red folder right here. And I think up to this point, let's see, where's the last? Well, you've got them updated here. It looks like this is it. This is what we've received up till this point. 145 emails in about 60 to 70 phone calls. So whatever that adds up to, almost 220 people. And I'll tell you, it's been excellent. And members, if you would like to come up the room 597 to take a look, we want to keep this up there, but you can come up and take a look at these. It runs the gamut. I mean, we've heard from senior citizens on fixed incomes who are seeing high property taxes, business owners, high market value increases, and we've had some great suggestions. Now, what we're doing with that is we're posting an idea of the day, and we've come up with three ideas of the day so far, and actually those are kind of ideas that are kind of out of the realm of maybe what we've been talking about, or out of the realm of the framework of the bill that is in the works. So kind of those things that maybe we haven't talked about. And so we will be doing that, and then as we get towards probably the end of February into early March, when we have to start looking at putting the report together, we'll produce a list of several ideas, and as a committee, come up with maybe 6 to 8 of those and put it into a citizens' omnibus property tax relief bill that we will then also try to get a hold of those who made the suggestions, have them come in and testify on that bill also. And that way, we can kind of put those ideas together and see where we go from there. So I do appreciate everyone who's contributed already. And like I said, members, if you care to take a look, just come up here. We have that. So, and welcome, members. And we don't quite have a quorum yet, but we will continue with our property tax overview. And what I'm looking at today is, I think in talking with staff here, this would go till about 8:45, 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock is kind of the deadline. And then we have three groups we're hearing from today, the senior citizens, the seasonal recreational, and business groups. Now, I have to apologize that not all groups have been included. We're trying to get kind of a sampling, and there's several business groups, so if you didn't get invited, don't feel offended. I'm sure you're going to have a chance to testify along the way in committee, and so as bills come up. But just trying to get a kind of an indication of what's out there and what are the concerns. So with that, Ms. Baker, Mr. Hines, please proceed, and good to see you this morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Baker. What I'm going to be talking about first is a packet that you should have in your folders called Property Tax Refund. It's half a dozen pages that I'm going to go through very quickly. They're also going to be up on the screen in case you want to look up there. Property tax relief is provided to homeowners and renters whose property taxes, or in the case of renters, it's rent constituting property taxes, is high relative to their income. The factors that are used in determining whether a claimant is eligible for this PTR, we call it, are based on property taxes relative to four factors. One is household income, And this is a very broad measure of income. It includes things that aren't taxable. It includes pensions and Social Security and, you know, railroad retirement, all sorts of things that, very broad definition. And then threshold of percentage of income is another factor. The claimant has to pay a certain percentage, and we'll see on the schedule in just a minute, because I have attached both the homeowner and the renter schedule so we can look at it, is what is often referred to as a co-payment, and then the maximum refund. So these are kind of the four factors that all interplay. And really, they are all incorporated so that when in the PTR schedules, when a taxpayer looks up in the form for whether or not they qualify, they look at their income and they look at their property taxes and they intersect at a certain point on the table. And in effect, all of these things have been built into the tables. And so they don't even know that there's different thresholds of percentages or that they have to pay certain co-payments. I mean, that is something which the legislature has set up in these schedules, but it's just built in for... if you look at the second page, you'll see, just to get a glance of what the homeowner schedule is, and you can see the income range, and the threshold is that they have to pay 1% of their income, and then, or 1% of the income, and then 15% they have to pay before the maximum kicks in, and the maximum is up to $1,700. And you can see that all of these factors, you can see how they vary depending on income. And in the homeowner schedule, the homeowner goes up to $91,120 is your top maximum. It actually takes two pages on this table. And the top threshold is 4% of your income, and the copay is at a high of 50%, and then it's just that the maximum refund declines from that top of $1,700 down to zero. The maximum also is indexed, and it's like what's shown in this table is what it will be now for filing for the in 07 for really the payable 07 property taxes. So this has already been indexed for this year. The next table is the same type of table except it's a renter schedule. And in this particular one, it shows that the income range for renters goes up to $49,160 for this year. And their maximum is $1,400. And if you compared the two, you'd see that the thresholds and the copays are not the same. It's more generous at the low end for renters. The next page is just a very quick, it's just program limits. And this is just kind of showing the program limits that also were shown on those previous pages. And that's maximum household income for homeowners and renters, showing the $91,000 versus the $49,000, and then the maximum refunds of $1,700 versus the $1,400. So that's just kind of a recap of those limits. The next page is showing how many filers we have, and you can see that it is broken down. This is for refunds filed in 05, which is the latest information that we have, and it shows... It's broken down by senior homeowners and non-senior homeowners, and then senior renters and non-senior renters. And you can see how many filers. We have about 500,000 filers in all. Refund amount is about $297 million in total. And the average refund ranges, well, it's 557 average, but you can see that the range isn't that great, from, you know, $505 up to $600. So it's a the next page is a page out of the major state aid report that Nina Manzi and I do every year, and the reason it says draft across here is because we have not issued this year's report yet. We're in the process of it, and this is the page that will be out of it. And the purpose of showing you this is just to give you a perspective of how much this program has changed in the way of amounts over the last 5 years from 2000 through 2004, or filed 2005. And it also shows where the property tax refund dollars in regions. You can see that the non-metro is about, like, if you look at 04, is about 92 million or 93 million versus the metro is 200 million. And we break it down so Hennepin and Ramsey are shown separately and then the remaining. And when we say metro here, we're talking about the seven metros. So, it, you know, it's the... and this just gives you kind of a picture of where those dollars are going. The last page is the special property tax refund program, which people often refer to as targeting. And this particular program provides relief to homeowners with more than a 12% tax increase. Its main distinction, really, from the regular PTR is that household income is not considered, which is a, and I think it probably is not known by a lot of people for that very reason, because a lot of people that don't file PTR could qualify for this and yet, you know, aren't aware of it. Although I have been talking to counties on this since our last hearing and looking at what counties are putting in with their property tax statements. And some are being pretty active in putting notices in with the statements saying you might qualify for, you know, not only the PTR, but also the targeting program. In that case, how this program works is you have to have at least a 12% increase and a $100 threshold. And then the state picks up 60% over that, up to $1,000. And for returns that were filed in 05, this particular program was $4.3 million and had 78,000 returns had been filed for an average refund of $55.
Representative Pemar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering that last comment you made, because I can't remember if Ramsey County includes something like a notice to homeowners about the two programs. And it seems to me that we should be doing whatever we can, and the county should be doing whatever we can to let our homeowners know that these two programs are out there. And I'm not sure how to get our arms around that, but I know Representative Linchesky has a really good flyer that she sends out to all the constituents that I've borrowed. But is there anything else we could be doing?
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pemar, actually, and I wish I would have brought it down here, is I did get emailed to me, although it is just an email, so the copy isn't colored and it doesn't look as nice as what an original would be, and I requested one, is there actually are flyers that are in with the property tax statement, and they're very narrow, which they aren't folded or anything, they're just a little, almost pocket kind of size, that is even in a different color. It's like bright pink or hot or orange or... so it's a very well-notified kind of, identified kind of thing that says, hey, folks, you know, something else might be, you know, you might qualify for something. And it actually says you might qualify for some property tax relief, and it says doesn't go into what the programs are as much as maybe it should. But it also then gives the website and the telephone number of the Department of Revenue, which, of course, is... where you have to file to get these. Also, these, both the PTR and the targeting are on the back side of the property tax statement. And so that's another way. Of course, if people escrow and they don't look much at the property tax statement and don't look much at either the back side or what's in the envelope because the bank is going to pay it and they escrow, then that's a problem. And maybe another option might be to put more in the truth in taxation statement, because counties have been very prohibited from putting anything in the truth in taxation statement. And maybe the legislature should change that language and say that language should be, or a flyer should be put in alerting people of the property tax refund and targeting in that, even though, you know, that's early, but, you know, maybe that's a better mechanism just because it then at least flags that when that property tax bill really comes, you know, it might be something that you better look at and file for. And, of course, all of these timing-wise, the criticism with the PTR in general is that when people go to file income tax, which this is part of the whole income tax filing process, or, you know, because it's when you go in and file income tax, your preparer often does your income tax plus this, and you usually don't have what you need at that time. And so people either have to go back or they have to be savvy enough to know what they're supposed to attach. You know, if they say, well, now all you have to do is take your tax statement and fill in this line and then you can, you know, send it in. You know, I don't know how many people, you know, feel comfortable or, you know, do that. So anyway, the timing issue really has been raised as an issue that those numbers, the property taxes and, you know, I don't think for renters it's as much of an issue because their CRPs should be issued earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But for property tax homeowners, it sure is because they don't have to come out till the end of March.
Mr. Representative Paymar.
Well, just a follow-up, Ms. Baker. So did I hear you say that the legislature prohibits including information about the property tax refund programs and the truth in taxation forms? Or did I miss that?
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, a little bit different than that. What I said is that the legislature has actually prohibited from putting additional information in with the truth in taxation with certain exceptions, like, for instance, Ramsey and St. Paul. They came in and asked for an exception to this. But in general, what the legislature was afraid of through the whole truth in taxation process, if they didn't have some kind of a prohibition, and maybe it's too strong, is they didn't know what counties, you know, would put in there. And I think they just, you know, at the time the truth in taxation was designed, it was kind of like, we want to control what the truth in taxation and what the inserts and everything look like. And so it wasn't at all for property tax refund and targeting that they were trying to prohibit putting that information. I think that is just recently coming out as a discussion as to maybe that's, you know, maybe that's one thing one needs to think about as to whether or not that's a good place to put it. But, so.
Representative Paymar.
So that's, Ms. Baker, so that's in statute somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
Can you get me that? I think we should, the more information we can get out to taxpayers, the better. And if we're doing something that's making it difficult for counties, then I think we should mm-hmm. change
yeah.
it.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up, Representative Paymar. That is a big issue. Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman, just real quickly, I'm sure that the legislature put it in because of fear that local governments will cloud it up so much nobody will know what it is. So I think we should still regulate what goes in.
I think that's a good point, Representative Mulry, and maybe just making sure that we emphasize those points where we have the state relief programs. And Representative Anderson, are you writing this down?
All of
this?
I
did. I've asked Representative Loeffler and Representative Anderson to kind of take the lead on the property tax refund portion of this. And so it's an area we really not only in looking at expanding the program, but also getting the notification out that in a better and timely way. So,
Mr. Chair, another thing might be, and this gets back to the property tax statement, is on the front side of the tax statement to have some kind of notice, even if it's not very much, to say, you know, you may qualify for a tax refund, and then turn this over for more information. I mean, so that, because there's only so much room on the front side of the tax statement, so you have to be pretty restrictive as far as how much you put on there. But if you alerted in some big letters that you should turn over, and then on the back you could describe the PTR and you can describe the tax statement, or the truth in taxation, or the targeting, I'm sorry. And then also on the back side is a schedule of penalties and interest rates. which also is a handy thing for taxpayers to know that if they don't pay their taxes in time, what kind of interest and penalties they're going to pay. That's another thing that's on the back of the
Except, Mr. Speaker, the front side of that property tax statement's been so frightening and scary lately, you would want to turn it over and possibly see more. But,
yeah.
All right,
yeah.
We will.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Baker. Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, I think the next thing that we'd like to do is talk a little bit about simulations that you're going to see
more a little later in the session, probably, but you'll be seeing the runs as proposals come forward. And we just wanted to take a few minutes to describe to you some of the policies surrounding the runs that we've that occasionally members have been confused about over the years. And there's a you can see the slide up on your screen that we're working from. The main ones we wanted to mention were that we do runs or simulations of school of K-12 finances. Aids to local governments, LGA, and county program aid, that would be...
Mr. Hines, if you would hold up just a second. There might be some in there. If you saved some from last week, there should be. Otherwise, it's this right here that we're working off of. House Research Computer Simulation Policy. But who doesn't have one? Check your save file first, and then... If not, if members, if you have some, if you could share. Well, we will try to get copies around to all the members, and Mr. Hines, why don't you just continue
Thank
from
you,
here.
Mr. Chairman. So the four types of models we want to talk about, the K-12 models for school finance, aids to local governments would be LGA and county program aid, income tax burdens, and we won't talk about that much in this division, and property tax burdens. The couple of things that, for the most part, requests for analyses of proposals that are sort of data intensive are handled like any other request for house research with confidentiality, et cetera. But sometimes there's a few issues that are a little different with regard to the simulations. The first is that lead time. Sometimes there's more lead time needed if you want like us to run a simulation for you. A lot of times it depends on the simulation being asked for, how complicated it is, how much it requires data that we don't already have, et cetera. So compared to just a question over the phone, a typical research question, a simulation may take more time. As with any legislative proposal, if you're working with us privately, everything we do with you is kept private until you decide to bring your proposal forward either as a bill or through a press conference, etc. So your simulation of something you're working on would be just between your office and our office. However, once a proposal becomes public, and that could be a bill, but it could just be through a press conference or something, then another member may say, I want to know what that proposal looks like, and we would be then obligated to run that simulation for the other member. But in that case, we will always make sure that the author of the proposal also receives that information at the same time, or even ahead of time. They give them a little bit of lead time to see what the simulation is saying, if they haven't already. But usually they've already been working with us. They already know what the simulation will show. But again, there's occasionally been sometimes where members have been a little confused about that policy, and so we try to make it explicit. That's most of the information on the first page. The second page, then, we have a little bit of information on the geographic detail. And for city LGA runs, primarily you're going to see these runs group where cities are grouped by city clusters. And those are a little bit unusual if you're not used to them. And In a few minutes, Ms. Dalton's going to walk through a printout, what a printout looks like, and she can talk more about those clusters. For the property tax simulations, those generally are portrayed in terms of 28 regions around the state that we generally display the output on. We can do individual city runs, but we don't usually do those when we're looking at the proposed tax year, because when we're before too much longer here, we'll be showing you a simulation of what we think pay 2008 property taxes are going to look like. And because that is all projections based on staff estimates, we tend not to go down to the city level on those. We tend to prefer that you look at those at the regional level. But if you want to look at historical, at pay 2007, pay 2006, we're happy to do those at the city-by-city level. And I think with that, I'll let... Do you want to do LGA first?
Oh, sure.
Ms. Dalton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you all have in your packet, before he puts it up on the screen, just a little four-page... It's part of a city LGA handout. Because it's 800 and now I believe beginning in 08 there will be 854 cities. So we're 853. We lost one and then we've added two. These printouts tend to run about 20, 22 pages depending on how much detail's on it. The things I want to point out about this are that...
Ms. Dalton, if you just hold up just a second, I want to make sure everyone has that so we can kind of follow along. Should have it in today's materials. But we have an extra couple extra copies if someone needs one. It has current law LGA versus final compromise. With 48, everyone, okay. Thank you, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, the run we're actually showing you is the run from the 2005 special session. It was the end of the conference committee compromise. We thought it might be a little bit more interesting than just looking at what current law is, because one of the things that I want to point out is that when there is a proposal, the cover sheet will actually show you, will list how the proposal differs from current law. And so if you look at the top section, it will tell you, you know, we're adding $48 million, we're removing taconite aid offset for certain cities, and we're giving extra money to cities with a population under 5,000. The other thing is, if there's something very unique about the run that we want to point out, we will put in a special note. We've talked about this in the volatility issue, that caps weren't adjusted, and so we knew that there was going to be a problem. And if you read that note, you will see that we actually did include it in the final, in the cover sheet of the final run, which was put on our website. So there was some notification. There was 306 cities that were capped. And we did talk about that in the note. And then finally, it will tell you what is shown in each column as you read across a printout. Steve talked a little bit about the fact that when we do city runs, we do not put them in either county order generally, nor do we put them in alphabetical order. Sometimes I know that would be really easy for people because it would be easier to find your cities. But there is actually a purpose for us to put them in the groupings that we do. The way we group cities is we group cities based on some common characteristics. The titles of the groups kind of define what those common characteristics are. We have 14 different groups. I believe five of them are in the metropolitan area, and the rest of them are, six of them are in the metropolitan area, and eight of them are in outstate Minnesota. This first page shows you central cities, clearly Minneapolis, St. Paul, large cities, older cities, which tend to be cities that were originally standalone cities that the suburbs grew up around, or they tended to be first-ring cities. The reason we provide you information like this is so you can see how cities, how different types of cities do under various proposals, and how a city does compare to cities that are similar to it. So it is a little confusing at first, and until you learn where your cities are located, what group, you know, feel free to contact us and we'll help you find your cities. But it is a way to help you kind of compare similar cities and also get a sense of how proposals are helping different types of cities.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, can I ask you, when you group these into the different areas or whatever, is a city only found in one area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, they are only found in one grouping, yes.
Mr. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So once I know where my cities are, which groupings my cities are located, I can pretty much always find them in those locations. Is that, would that be good to say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton, why isn't Osseo in an older city?
Dalton.
In the metro. It's certainly older. At one time there was an actual note to the French government from their representative in the United States saying that Minneapolis wouldn't amount to anything because it was too close to Osseo.
Ms. Dalton, not to respond to that comment, but to the rather the quote. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulray, the groupings of cities are actually, I hate to say this, are based on a statistical analysis called cluster analysis. And what we did is we look at four different characteristics of cities: city size, age of the housing stock, population growth rate, and the amount of tax basis in commercial industrial property. And the statistical analysis basically goes around and maps all of these cities and all four characteristics and then says, okay, all the cities that are closest together into a ring, they will go into that group. Now, occasionally you have cities like Osseo. Hermantown is another one that we've had problems with, that it could really kind of go in one of two places. It's pretty close to two different clusters. It's kind of sitting by itself. And that it's statistically just a little closer to this group than to that group, to being similar to this group than to that group. So in this case, Osseo, because of its commercial industrial development, ended up in the diversified cities, the cities with a lot of commercial industrial as well as residential, as opposed to in the older cities. Or conversely, it could have also been in these small cities. It was relatively close to all three, and it was one of the last cities that actually got statistically assigned to a group.
All right. Thank you much. Anything else on the local government aid runs? Or? All right. Thank you much.
Mr. Chairman, then the next set of pages will be the ones that look like this. That top says property tax simulation report.
I believe that was in your saved file.
Again, hopefully that should have been handed out.
And if not, we will try to get a few more of those out.
Number 718?
Yes, that's correct. Number 782.
It should look like this, members.
And I didn't want to spend much time here on this, but just to give you a few, point a few things that you'll need to look for when you start seeing these runs. As Representative Demmer pointed out, in the upper left corner, there's a name of the simulations, and this one says 7A2. It's useful just to remember that, or if you see two different ones, to see if that's referring to the same one that you may have seen or been talked about before. It's just an identifier that's on every page of the run. The date is sometimes important, obviously. The box kind of that's circled in the toward the middle of the page there is a bit of a description of why this run was done, what it differs, how it differs from previous runs, etc. It tries to flag up some of the changes that are in the run, although it because there's so many different aspects of the property taxes, lots of times it won't be very, very detailed about what's all included in the run. And perhaps I should have then pointed above that box to say the simulations always compare two different situations. One is called the baseline and one is called the alternative. And they're defined on this top cover sheet and on each page of the run what the baseline and the alternative is in the simulation. This is a situation where the baseline is 2006 property taxes and the alternative is 2007, based on the truth in taxation levies. This is a very common run for this time of year for people to be looking at. Sometimes the baseline will say pay 2008, say current law, but the alternative might be pay 2008 under Representative X's proposal. That's another typical kind of run you would see. So always be aware of what the baseline and the alternative are. It's mentioned on each page, but it's always at the top of the page, not always at the columns where you're, that you're looking at. The second page of the simulations is are the assumptions that go into each of the two characteristics. In this case, the assumptions aren't very long because they're mostly just describing current law. They're short, but in terms of a simulation, we get into how we had to estimate some things that maybe aren't straightforward or we didn't have as good a data on as we typically would. The next page is just the chart of the class rates being used in the run. Again, those are the things that are most likely to change for simulation is the class rates on each type of property, so they're summarized at the beginning of the run. The next two pages then are maps of the regions that are used, and the first map shows the regions in greater Minnesota. And they're a little bit hard to read, perhaps, where the heavier lines are, but there's basically seven geographic areas, I believe. And then each geographic area is usually there's a separate region for the cities in that area, and for the towns are considered separately. Similar page for the metro area, where we have regions that are somewhat equal in terms of the amount of property within the area. So Hennepin County is actually split up into four pieces because it's so much bigger than the others. Ramsey County is split into a St. Paul and suburban. And then Anoka, Washington, Dakota are just the counties are the regions. Carver and Scott are together. You get used to these regions as you work with these runs over time. And both these property tax runs and the LGA runs are on our website as well, and that's probably maybe where you'll be more likely to be finding them now than in hard copy, but they look the same. The next page that's up on the screen is, and all the pages really look the same, so I'm just going to spend a little time on this. Is the upper right corner of this is describes the geographic area that's being summarized on this page, and in this case, page one is the statewide page. Common figures that are looked at on the statewide page are on the left. You see the property classes are listed on the left-hand side. The first set of numbers refers to the market value in the run, and then the numbers on the right-hand columns refer to the tax burden. So, for instance, in this case, between pay 2006 and pay 2007. Taxable market value on existing homes grew by 8.2%, and tax burdens are growing by net tax burden is growing by 6.9%. Statewide averages for both of those numbers, for instance. I circled down at the end of the list of property classes. You'll see the overall growth by all types of property. Market values grew 11.8%. between 2006 and 2007, and net tax burden growing by 9.3%. Again, these are kind of the numbers people are most likely to look at, but there can be importance in all of them. Over in the far right, you'll see the effective tax rates, another comparison tool that we often use in talking about taxes around here. And it shows for the baseline and the alternative. So notice that the column headings always say baseline and alternative. And what does that mean? Go to the top of the page where those two terms are defined for that run, what the baseline is, what the alternative is. The next page, I said the pages were all the same. They are all the same. The next page is I put up the metro page, I guess. The rest of the pages do have this other section on the bottom which shows the tax burdens on hypothetical properties. And it shows like for four different values of homes, and then for apartments, commercial, industrial, in areas that have seasonal recreational, there'll be seasonal recreational properties listed there, what the changes are in the run for those types of properties. And sometimes that's helpful to get it, to see how that it's not as uniform across all types of homes, for instance, a proposal or a run as it might be. In this case, the values are all the same, 8.3, but the tax change varies a little bit because of other features of the system. No, it's a lot to digest, but just giving you a little bit of a preview of something, as I said, you'll be seeing over the next few months.
Mr. Hines, when we produce a report from the Property Tax Division, ultimately goes to the Tax Committee, what comes out of there, you would be able to put something together. This would be the alternative, would be, for example, the proposed, you know, 08, 09. And so members would be able to look at, for example, is it providing property tax relief equally to all areas? You'd be able to do this?
Exactly, Mr. Chairman. That would be one of the main runs we'd be doing, is what the division's report, including all the provisions that the division's put in the bill, would contain, yes.
Also, Mr. Hines, when I see the Department of Revenue will put out statistics saying property taxes are going up X percent, do they get those numbers from you, or do you work with the Department of Revenue on this, or how does that work? Because it always seems to match up.
But good question, Mr. Chairman. The Senate Research and the Department of Revenue and House Research work together to try to get as much concurrence as possible on the underlying assumptions of our runs, to try to minimize the amount of dueling numbers that are supposed to be the same, representing the same thing. They're not always matching exactly, but we do work together quite a bit to try to coordinate them and check each other's work and try to home in on. So there are three different agencies doing them, but we do spend a lot of time trying to get on the same page.
Representative Runcheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, when you do the tax burdens on hypothetical property as part of the property tax modeling, and you have a market value, say, for 06 from the assessors, and then you have an alternative assumption, and it shows, say, on a home, say, market value going up, where are you getting that higher value number for a home, say? Is it actually coming from the county assessors, or are you speculating? It seems to me there'd be a lag in trying to get data. Do you understand what I'm saying? Say, for example, on your handout that you just had us looking at, the last sheet, the tax burdens on hypothetical properties, say you took the first four properties or homes, and on a baseline you've got them valued at different amounts, 101, and then on the alternative you have the value go up. Is that coming from a hard number from a county assessor, or is that doing your best to see what's happening in the market?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, there's a couple different things that your question brings up. The first of all, the four values are always the average, low, high, and extra high, just statistical numbers. In the case of when we start modeling pay 2008, that will be, those market values will be projections that are not coming from the counties for the most part. They're developed by this group of House, Senate, and us working together to try to develop those projections. We do seek some and get some input from the counties on them, but they're anything but official. It's very early in the year for them to know. Now that wouldn't affect it differently between the different values of the homes.
Right.
So in this case, you see that 8.3% would be the same value increase to all homes in a given geographic area on those hypothetical properties.
Representative Runcheski.
If I may ask, and so for the alternative column going forward when a legislator has a proposal, I'm just trying to understand, you know, we're always hearing that various things are happening in the market and then people are sort of projecting it out in their mind when they're introducing legislation. So, for example, I think what people hear mostly now, and we'll see if, you know, this becomes true, that commercial industrial values are expected to basically skyrocket, and homes may flatten out, hopefully not decrease, but may flatten out. So is this group just trying to take their best shot at what they're hearing from the industry? Are you interacting with the real estate industry to get a sense of what might really be, you know, best forecasting?
Mr. Hines? Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, we don't specifically interact with the industry, but we're kind of tap into all of our awareness of who we've talked to, what we think's going on, and try to build that into the estimates. But then our touchstone is always that we do send them out to the counties and say, how do these look to you?
Okay.
And hope the counties will flag up, you know, if they know where we're off or off base. But since we're only going out 1 year, a lot of times these trends people are talking about are further out than that, perhaps. And at the 1 year level, it doesn't get very real sophisticated modeling.
Thank you.
And I should have maybe said, too, that we talked about the value, but a lot of really the more conjecture part of the estimates are in levies and how those are driving property taxes in the projected year. And those, there's a lot less to even hang your hat on than there is for the value side. And that modeling what cities are going to do, counties are going to do, because it's a behavioral issue, whereas the market values are more just a case of understanding the underlying economic conditions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we're going to just go back and very briefly to the LGA program. You have a one-page handout of slides. We're actually going to start with the third slide and just talk very briefly. During the full committee, we actually kind of went through the formula a little bit. So what we're going to talk about now is just maybe some policy issues that you should be aware of, or what are going to be the issues that you hear talked about in LGA. One thing that you need to kind of remember is the LGA program as it exists now is not the LGA program that originally existed in 1971. The original LGA program was a revenue sharing program that went to all local governments. Schools, special taxing districts, towns, counties, everybody got local government aid back in the 70s. And over time, this has progressed to being a city-only program. The other big policy shift, it has gone from being a general revenue sharing program to one that is really based on trying to send aid to cities with the greatest need, or the greatest need and the least amount of ability to pay. So only about 50% of the population in the city now, in the state, actually now lives in cities that get LGA. The rest of the population actually lives in cities that don't get LGA, or they live in townships that also don't get LGA. So that's just a shift that people should be aware of.
Representative Demmer. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, what's that percentage again?
It's about 50%.
50%.
One of the areas that will be discussed a lot will be issues in the funding level. And one of the phrases people will start hearing is restoring full funding.
Representative Mallory.
Sure, Ms. Dalton. That's just, if 50%, we have all these other aids, you know, program aid, different things, is there any correlation that they sometimes get more of other aids than if they don't get an LGA, or
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mallory, city LGA is the only general purpose aid for cities. There is no general purpose aid for towns at all anymore. And county program aid, of which there's about $200 million, which is about 40% of the level of LGA, is the general purpose aid program to counties. Now, counties get a lot of their money. The vast majority of their intergovernmental aid is categorical aid. It's transportation aid, and it is health and human service aid through a number of different programs. And, you know, I really can't speak to who gets what of those programs. Funding levels. One, as I said, one of the things that you'll hear about is you'll hear about full funding. And when people are talking about full funding, they could be talking about one of two possible things. They could either be talking about increasing the appropriation to the amount that LGA was prior to the 2003 cuts, which was $587 million. They may actually mean even more than that, because prior to 2003, there was also an inflation factor. So sometimes when they're talking about full funding, they're talking about restoring it back to the $587 million plus all the growth that should have occurred between 2003 and 2007 or 2008 if the inflation factor had continued to be applied to the appropriation. So you just need to be clear. The other thing that they could be talking about is they could be talking about funding 100% of the unmet need for each city as determined by the formula. And that is a totally different amount. Right now, we fund about 91% of unmet need. The difference between a city's need is measured by the formula and its ability to pay. So you aren't going to need nearly as much money to pay 100% of unmet need as, you know, so if they're talking about full funding that way, that's not as much money as if you're talking about full funding to restore everything back from the cuts. One of the things I think is really important for people to remember is the formula is relative, particularly the need measure. It's not clear that we are measuring all of city need. As a matter of fact, it's pretty clear that we are not measuring all of city need. Nor are we measuring all of the city's ability to raise revenue, because the only thing we're looking at is their tax base. Therefore, this is really a relative measure. People sometimes think of unmet need as you know, an absolute, and once we've made that, every city's fine. But that's not necessarily true. This is just telling you what one city needs relative to another city, which cities are needier than others. The formula does not tell you what is the correct appropriation level. That's really a policy decision for you. And to kind of illustrate that, there is an issue of what happens to the appropriation, what happens if the appropriation is so large that you can pay 100% of unmet need under the current formula. Do you pay the cities who currently get aid more than 100% of unmet need, or do you reduce the effort required and put more cities on the formula? Those are some of the trade-offs that you have to think about. The other thing you're going to hear about is, you know, issues with the formula. And normally when people are talking about issues with the formula, they're often talking about issues with the measures of city need. And we talked about why do we include access and rates and things like that. The one thing I want to point out is that there is no one correct formula for need. How you judge a formula, well, for one thing, there's limitations on the methodology and data available. We can only measure need if we have data that we can, that we collect, all 853 cities. And, you know, there's a lot of data we don't have for a lot of cities, particularly the cities under 2,500. Policy goals matter. You know, are you trying to help the neediest cities? Are you trying to do revenue sharing more broadly? Do you want to make sure that all cities can provide average services? Do you want to make sure that all cities can provide some minimal level of services? All of those discussions really go into any discussion of formula. And the last thing I want to point out is generally formulas can take into account factors that may be very important to only a few cities. One of the reasons accident rates actually ended up in the formula is there were a couple of things that were very important to a few cities that ended up being correlated to this. There were a number of cities who came in and said, we are a college town. You know, we have all these students in, you know, in coming in for school, and they produce an overburden on our city. But there aren't that many college cities. We had a Minneapolis come in and say, we have all these parks and museums, and that pulls a lot of people in, and that causes overburden in our community. But that didn't show up as being a significant factor because that was really a factor unique to Minneapolis. St. Paul came in and said, we have all of these government, tax-exempt government buildings sitting in our jurisdiction. Everyone comes in. That causes an overburden. Well, again, that may be very important for St. Paul, but it won't show up in a general formula because it's not important enough to enough cities. And so to that extent, accident rate actually ended up being a measure of congestion that was kind of correlated with all of these things, and that's how that actually ended up in the formula. But there will always be issues of factors that are very important in determining a city's need and may cause a city to have unique need that won't ever show up in a general formula. And some formulas are better than others. I said there's no one correct formula, but there are things that, you know, you should really think about not doing. You don't want to provide incentives to spend more. You don't want to tie how much money you get to how much money you spend directly. Because guess what? People will spend more then. You probably want to base formulas on factors that cities cannot manipulate. You do not want this to be something that they can, you know, as Representative Rucavina suggested put up the stop sign on Spring and cause there to be more accidents so you can actually get more money. And then finally, there are the issues of volatility. As I talked about with the general, with the full committee, there was some extra one-time volatility in 2007, between 2006 and 2007, caused by the fact that we didn't increase those caps in 2005 when we added $48 million. And so that's what's really driving, you know, a lot of the discussion, because people were so shocked with what happened in 2007. But having said that, there really is some volatility due to the fact that 94% of the appropriation is distributed every year under the formula. You know, it used to be only 40% was distributed by the formula and 60% was guaranteed. And you know, if 60% is guaranteed, you aren't going to see as much variation as if only, you know, less than 6% is guaranteed. And finally, there are the fact that the new formula gives a lot more weight to certain factors, and so some small changes in some of the factors can have some fairly significant impacts on aids paid to some individual cities.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, you were talking about the issues with how we determine what to give, and I'm just... Was it ever taken into account a limit on what portion of the LGA plus levy a city might get? In other words, if we're paying them 88% of their total LGA and levy, they're only levying 12%. I think I've seen that in the past in some small places around the state or into the 80s. It seems like there's not much incentive to hold on costs, or were those cities that had extreme needs or something like that? I didn't notice any of that high in the run we got this year, but...
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, particularly, and Representative Mulry, particularly back when the grandfather existed, we had some cities that were getting an enormous amount of aid, you know, in the order of $500 and $600 per capita, not because the formula said that they needed it, but because they were much larger cities back in the 70s, and at that time, once you got money, you got to keep it forever. And so they were getting aid based on the fact that they had, their population essentially declined, but we were still giving them aid as if they were much larger cities. And so they did have that factor. Now, having said that, you really don't want... There are some problems if you actually say at least X percent of your money must come from levy. What if, you know, because the way the formula is set up, you're trying to provide enough money to cities that they can provide average services with an average tax base. And what if you have a city that chooses to provide less than average services? Do you want to penalize them? If they want to keep their tax rate lower, then they would need to fund average services, because they've decided as a city that they don't want to provide average services, they want to provide minimal services. Do you want to penalize them? If you do, essentially what you're telling them is you will all provide average services, because otherwise you're not going to have money even to meet your minimal services. We're going to take money away from you.
Good question.
Representative Demp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, I understand the volatility issue, and the reason that volatility is a problem is for planning for cities as they look at their budgets going forward. Can you speak to the notification of cities, and I know larger cities, for example, that have staff people that follow this on a day-by-day basis, they're pretty much up to speed once the decision is made here in St. Paul. I would venture to say that there are a lot of small communities that don't have, you know, they have the half-day city clerk and the mayor that works full-time someplace, and chances are they don't know right away, you know, what the changes are here when final decisions are made in May of the year of the determination of what this is going to be. Can you speak a little bit to how the information flows out to communities about what their LGA will be after a final determination is made by the legislature.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, we actually do put all of our runs on the website. They're available to anybody who wants to go on to our website. My understanding is the League of Minnesota Cities, in their end of session report, you know, they put this same information into their big report, and they do it for every city, so they make it available. And most of the other city lobbying groups do similar things, do end of session reports saying what is available. The actual certified numbers are not available until August 1. And this actually gets to a problem with, you know, our projections versus the certification. We make our best guess on what we think is happening to population in individual cities. We have pretty good information on what is actually happening with the tax base because there's a one-year delay in the tax base used in LGA. But population numbers, which are one of the big driving factors, don't come out until July. I think it's July 1st or July 15th, and I think it's actually July 15th now. And so we're working off of projected what we think is going to happen to population, and so those numbers that we have at the end of session may be different than the numbers that actually get finally certified, because there are some pieces of the information that go into the formula that we just don't have in May.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton, thank you for making the distinction on the different definitions of full funding. With the first definition, it would take, as I recall, about $100 million to restore back to the level of 2003. What would be the amount on the 100% of unmet need?
Just about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I don't know right offhand, but I can get that information.
Okay, thank you. The other question I have...
Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is, if you followed either definition, does it have any effect on volatility?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, big issue with volatility has to do with the caps that we put on people. There are a number of cities, and going back to using the example where I said we had some small cities that were getting $600 per capita. The formula isn't just taking all of that money away from them in one fell swoop. There are caps that are basically on their decreases, that are basically moving them down gradually to what the formula says they should get. Conversely, if a city had not been getting any aid in the past, and now the formula says that they should get a significant amount of aid, we have caps that are saying we're going to move you there gradually. If we put more money into the system and we do not adjust those caps, you get that bounce effect that we got in 2006 and 2007. So one of the things you have to be very careful about is if you put more money into the system, what is the appropriate cap to put on increases so you don't cause people to go up and down and up and down. But that's really the volatility issue related to appropriation.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I may have had this answered by Representative Lanning's question, but what level are we appropriating local government now? 487 then, about a $100 million less than
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, that is correct. We had cut them by about $150 million, and we restored $48 million in 2006, and we have about $100 million left to restore.
Okay.
If you want to get back to the 2003 level.
Thank you.
Thank you much, and we're going to stop with the House research presentation. I know there's a few more areas, and we can come back at a later date. And also, when we cover these bills, there's thank you very much, Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines, Ms. Dalton, for your presentations today. At this time, I would like to entertain a motion to approve the January 26th minutes. Representative Paymar moves to approve the January 26, 2007 minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, I will call for a vote on the approval of those minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Yeah.
Thank you. At this time, then, we will hear from the Minnesota Senior Federation. If you would please come forward, and we would like to limit your comments, everyone, today to 3 minutes. That's one boxing round. So if and so if you could, we'll give you a little warning, and that'll leave some time for questions. So good morning.
Good morning. It's 6 minutes in the home, my home last night. That's sort of the time I had. But I'll try and make it into 3 minutes, because it isn't going to be too hard. The property tax, without a doubt.
State your name, please.
My name is Marlo Hammerston. I'm the chairman of the Tax Committee of the Minnesota Senior Federation. The Minnesota Senior Federation had its convention last fall. For the first time in my memory, had property taxes as the number one issue to work on. And the reason it's the number one issue is that the property tax, without a doubt, is the worst tax in the civilized world. That's not my opinion, that's the opinion of Edwin Seligman, author, economist, and tax expert. And he made that statement in 1895. So we haven't done too much. The property tax problem still exists and is still a problem for us. And it's up to the 2007 legislature to put an end to this festering problem. The first step in solving any problem is to define the problem. It is the position of the Minnesota Senior Federation that the core of Minnesota's property tax problem is that it is an unlimited tax. No other tax is unlimited. The income tax has a limit to the percentage of one's income that can be taken by this tax. There is a limit to the percentage of the sale price that can be taken by the sales tax. There's a definite limit to the gasoline tax, a fixed amount for each gallon of gasoline you purchase. Government has recognized that establishing limits in structuring our taxes is a way to create fairness. All taxes must have a limit to create fairness, to create uniformity, and to treat citizens equally. Every tax in Minnesota has some form of limitation except one. There is no limit to Minnesota's property tax. The property tax can take any percentage of a Minnesotan's income without limit that the assessor's guess, I repeat, the assessor's guess of your property's value produces. If the problem with the property tax is its unlimited nature, there's a very simple and obvious solution. Establish a limit. We need to bring our property tax into conformity with the rest of our systems of taxation. The Minnesota Senior Federation proposes that that 5% is a reasonable limit for a Minnesota homestead property owner's contribution to support local government. The present property tax refund program, known as the PTR or the circuit breaker, would remain unchanged under our proposal. Local governmental units would lose no funding, just as none is lost with the present circuit breaker. The standards for participation in this super circuit breaker program would be the same as the PTR program. The transition would be seamless. There would be no age requirement. This is not a senior-only program. The property tax is just as much a problem with the single family, the single mom, the single parent. It's just as much a problem for young families trying to purchase a home, trying to plan their future, when they're faced with unlimited increases in property taxes, with no assurance of any corresponding increase in income. With the establishment of a limit to the property tax, Minnesota homestead property owners receive the protection from being driven from their homes. Government should not be allowed to control where the citizens of our state can or cannot live through tax policy. We often hear of a system of income tax, sales tax, and property taxes to provide the stability in revenue collection that's attributed to a three-legged stool. Today's three-legged tax stool has an income tax leg of 5.35% if your income is less than $29,000. The Minnesota sales tax leg is 6.5% for all Minnesotans. The property tax leg varies, however, from 0.04% if you're in the top 1% of income earners to 20% for many Minnesotans. When our house research speaks of all the averages, remember they're averages. There are extremes, and what we need to protect are those at the extremes. When you look at those numbers, it doesn't produce much stability in that imaginary stool. Stability will only be achieved when we saw off that out-of-control property tax leg to a length that conforms with the other two legs. The end of the worst tax in the civilized world will only occur when this legislature acts to end unlimited taxation. The 2007 session is the time to act and fulfill last fall's promises to reform Minnesota's homestead property tax system.
Thank you very much.
Did I fit the time in?
You're good. Thank you much. So, all right. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep, Mr. Weigel from the AARP, or that's not a mister here. You would please state your name for the committee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chairman Marquardt and members, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today about property taxes from the perspective of an older Minnesotan. I'm Shirley Hunt Alexander, AARP's State Advocacy Chair, and I have a short statement to read and appreciate again, as I said, this opportunity. The property tax can and be the single most burdensome tax for many low-income seniors. Property tax burdens are rising in much of the state, raising concerns among and about people being forced out of their homes because of their inability to pay their property taxes, and I'm sure you're hearing that. AARP is particularly interested in proposals to help alleviate the property tax burden. We support efforts to take pressure off the regressive property tax and shift it to taxes that are better correlated with ability to pay, such as the income tax. AARP also believes that when property tax relief is provided, it should be done in an equitable manner and should primarily benefit low to moderate income homeowners and renters. AARP has serious reservations with arbitrary property tax caps because they are generally bad public policy and restrict jurisdictions' ability to respond to changing public needs and priorities. We support Minnesota's current homestead market value credit and property tax refund programs. We urge you to increase education efforts on the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program, especially for homeowners who might face the loss of their home because of their inability to pay escalating property taxes. Now, AARP's national policy urges states to avoid tying property tax breaks to age or to housing values, and instead supports using a measure of homeowners' ability to pay, in other words, income, as the basis for tax relief. This fosters intergenerational equity and better protects the tax base from erosion with the aging of the population. Now, there's more information about our national policy on the Internet, and that's on your statement there. Thank you.
Ms. Alexander, thank you so much. Are there any questions for Mr. Hammerson or Ms. Alexander at this time? Any questions? And if you want, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Alexander, I appreciate this statement, and I just wondered if you had a thought. I'm not sure how involved you personally are with AARP's excellent program they have to assist people in preparing their taxes.
Right.
And one of the things I think that legislators have just cannot seem to figure out how to do this is how to get senior citizens to want to do that property tax deferral program. And I am delighted to see that you have highlighted that. And we here all know what a great property tax relief program that is, yet participation is so low. And we've tried to find ways to get the word out there. Do you have any insight as to how we might better perform there for seniors?
Personally, I don't. But I would be very pleased to go back to the group that is working on the tax consulting and ask them for their recommendations and get back to you on it, if that would be helpful.
That would be great.
That would be great. Thank you.
And maybe we could even have some of them come and just share some of their thoughts with you, because this is a very interesting and high-powered group that is doing that work, and I've been impressed with them.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I think that would be excellent. I have heard members bipartisanly for years on the property tax committee in greater Minnesota, in the urban area, really knowing how much this helps our senior citizens and really allows them to stay in their home and not have to pay those property taxes. Yet Ms. Baker always gives us the participation numbers, and we just can't get Minnesotans to use the program. And so I think that would be really helpful if you wouldn't mind spending some time or with the right people with me, because I think that's one thing. I know Chairman Marquardt has worked on it as well. Really, it's a founding issue.
Yeah. Representative, please appreciate the opportunity, and we'll certainly be back to you, sir.
Thank you, and thanks for those comments, Representative Chesky, for bringing that up. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Alexander. On the last point or topic of discussion, I think it would be particularly useful, too, as you contrast it with reverse mortgages, which are being heavily marketed to seniors, and the closing costs and the risks, you know, the financial costs of those are just outrageous in many circumstances, and this is so much of a better deal. And I'm afraid that many seniors who are in desperate situations sign up for reverse mortgages, not understanding sort of other options that are available to them. But I wanted to ask you a question about another concept, and that is on your piece that you indicate the AARP national policy is not to tie property tax breaks to housing values, and that's been a long tradition in Minnesota to say that we look at lower value homes, which oftentimes are a reflection of income, and we treat them in a more advantaged state basis for tax relief than someone who owns a $1 million home. And I'm so intrigued by what the perspective was here.
Chairman Margaret and Representative, I could speculate personally as to what this might mean. I think what they're really saying is that property tax is a very regressive tax, and we need to be looking at a more equitable tax for our local communities. That's oversimplifying it. But I understand what you're talking about, that there's an equity that comes in if you value a house less, and then you have a lower rate for that, etc. So let me also look into that a little bit further, and if there's more that we could share with you, I'd be pleased to do that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And Mr. Hammerston, again, thank you so much. And out of many of these comments are coming from seniors, so we're hearing from you, certainly. We have a couple groups left, and I want to ask right now, is there anyone from out of town here that is here to testify with one of these groups? Because what I'm thinking of is going to the seasonal recreational. Mr. Forster, I know, is here next, and then at a later time coming back to the business groups, because we're not going to have time. So is there anyone that isn't here on a regular basis? I want to make sure if someone's here specifically today. Anyone out there? Okay, so there's no objection then if we can go, because that's going to be 5 minutes and then we're going to wrap up. So I want to apologize to the Chamber and the Business Partnership and the Realtors, but you will have your time here in front of the committee, but I appreciate your cooperation. So if Mr. Forster from the seasonal recreation groups, And members, there is a handout in your packet entitled Study of Minnesota Resident Seasonal Property Ownership.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Marquardt and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forster, and I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners. And we were started on Lake Vermilion in about 1994. And the following year, 1995, the Minnesota Taxpayers Association released their report that Minnesota taxed seasonal property more aggressively than any state in the country. And since then, we've kind of worked to change that. I don't know where we're ranked anymore because the Taxpayers Association no longer breaks out seasonal property. I'll try and skip through my comments here. Basically, our problem is that seasonal properties use far less property tax-supported services than homesteads. Seasonal property cannot vote in for local levy referendums, creating a taxation without representation problem. Seasonal property does not get homestead credit, circuit breaker protection, targeted tax credits, deferrals for seniors, veterans, or disabled, and in the cashback refunds of the past, we've never participated in that either. In 2001, two things happened with seasonal. In recognition of our taxation without representation problem, seasonal property was excluded from the excess school operating levies. And I often see editorials in local papers claiming that if seasonal property were put back on the levies, school funding issues would be solved. Seasonal property is paying far more into the state general tax than we did in school operating levies statewide, about 10 times more. But none of this money is making it back to local communities, and that seems to be the problem. Also in 2001, the state began the phase-out of limited market value to recapture lost tax base. But that is the year that there was a stock market crash, and investors began casting about and discovered Minnesota Lakeshore, which still outperforms Wall Street. So just as limited market value began to phase out, the value of Lakeshore property was sent through the roof by a speculative market. Anyone who has spent time on the lakes has seen the impact. Homes and condos blooming where once there were only rustic cabins or wild shoreline. One woman, a single teacher with a cabin on Leech Lake that her father built in the 1950s for $500, had a 430% increase in her assessed value after a developer from Florida put a gated community on the property next door to her. And if you look at the tax bills that I've included for you, none of those increases are due to new construction. So it's all just this sort of escalating market value on the lakes. In 2005, two pieces of legislation passed that cabin owners were very grateful for, an extension of limited market value and an adjustment in the state general tax. Because seasonal property was going up so quickly in comparison with CI, the percentage share of the state tax we pay had almost doubled. In 2005, the legislation rolled it back to 2001 levels and fixed it there. LMD was also extended for 2 years in an effort to give properties time to catch up with the phase out. But since then, seasonal property and agricultural property has continued to increase faster than the rate of phase out, so there's still a larger gap for us now than there was in 2001 when the phase out began. I've sent all of you a copy of our agenda, so I won't go over that, but I just wanted to stress that cabins in Minnesota are heirlooms and not assets. According to the study that I gave you, almost 90% of owners do not consider their cabins investments and they do not want to sell them. As further proof, the average length of ownership of a seasonal property in Minnesota is 25 years. The national average home ownership for a home is 6 years. And nationally, the length of time a person owns a cabin is 4 years. So we have a very different market here in Minnesota than the rest of the country, and this cabin culture is falling apart. It's about to be destroyed. It is a public policy issue, I think, because whenever the purse holder is in no way accountable to the person who must fill the purse, there is a problem. There is an environmental issue. By taxing Lakeshore so aggressively, Minnesota is ensuring two things. First, the transfer of Lakeshore from local owners of moderate means to non-local owners of higher means. As an example of this, the two districts with the most cabin owners living in them are not South Minneapolis and St. Paul, but Virginia and Ely. In the 4 years I've been executive director, however, I've seen these numbers fall. Second, there is a great deal of debate about tightening shoreline development regs in the state, but little talk of the root issue. Escalating taxes force development, and development is one of the main causes of surface water pollution in the state. If the legislature is serious about protecting water, then it will provide incentive for those who manage shoreline in a way that benefits all. And seasonal recreational property is the largest ownership block of shoreline and forest land in the state. The national forests are about 20%. I think the state is 16. There's timber and tribes in there. But most of the land is privately owned. So anything we do to impact that will have twice the effect that it would have on, say, the national forests in the state. In closing, I want to thank you for your time, and as you consider property tax reform ideas, I ask you on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of cabin and hunting landowners in the state to restore some fairness and common sense to a system that is out of control. We want to pay our fair share, but currently we're paying far more than our fair share. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Forrester? Representative Paymar.
Well, I'd just like to know what you would recommend to the legislature.
Mr. Forrester?
Well, I think that your extension of the limited market value for another 2 years would be a good idea. I think that the time to phase out limited market value is when the market slows. And it hasn't done that for seasonal recreational property yet. Although it has somewhat for homes. We have a bill called Blue Waters that's been around here for years. And that would, if you enroll your property in Blue Waters, you must have owned it for 7 years. You enroll it in Blue Waters. It's a covenant that travels with the property. It lowers the tax rate to 0.65%. If you sell the property, the covenant goes with the property. If someone wants to get out of Blue Waters, they have to pay 7 years in back taxes. So it sort of foils the speculator, but it provides incentive to people to keep large blocks of undeveloped land undeveloped. And right now the incentive is all towards development. You know, somebody with 2,500 feet of shoreline can't afford to keep it together. They have to break it up and sell it. I think that it would be great if seasonal property got some of the same considerations that homesteads got, like circuit breaker, if your tax bill. I mean, there's a tax bill in there where the tax bill went up 80%. You know, there's no circuit breaker or targeted tax relief for that. Some of these programs, I think, would be very good. The deferral that we talked about earlier for seniors would be great. These places, you know, 25 years, a lot of these places are second and third generation places. And people have to sell them because they can't afford to keep them late in life, and it's bad for the families, and I think it's also bad for the local communities.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, and we'll have time as the year goes on and bills come up.
Much.
But thank you so much, all the testifiers, and again, I apologize to the business groups. A couple announcements before we end today. Mr. Strom has a salmon Dusty Rose pink copy here of record runs last week that he wanted to share with all members. Then also, by Wednesday, staff here has said he will have kind of a summary of some of the comments. But again, members, you're welcome. Come up to room 597 and look through those if you wish. And then Tuesday, there is a joint tax property tax relief committee meeting. Again, the Madam Chair has been gracious to do this, and we're going to be looking at 2006 assessment reports by the Department of Revenue. So with that, members, have a great weekend. Stay warm, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. We're adjourned.